wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, your listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patrick Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspective on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromise news media. Today, songs are going to be one of the main features of our program. We're going to play snippets from four inspirational songs from a left political perspective. And at the conclusion of our program today, Bill Resnick will interview Jeff Hunt, a local musicologist who is well-versed in the popular music scene and its leftist offerings. We'll begin the program today with one of those songs. Immediately following that, Bill Resnick will interview Travin Lation, a labor organizer and writer who knows guns and guns control. They'll be discussing the big picture on how to stop gun violence. I'll be reading an article entitled, "The Technology Being Used to Control Workers by Tech Companies is Freakishly Dystopian," by Thor Benson. The article was recently published in These Times. Larry Bolden, our Old Mole book reviewer, is going to do something a little different today. Rather than reviewing a single work, Larry's going to discuss a genre of fiction that is sometimes described derogatively as women's fiction or romance fiction. Larry has a radically different take on the importance of this alleged genre. But now, let's get started with the first of the four inspirational songs that are featured on today's program. I'm Free by The Who. I think most of it recognizes it from the rock opera Tommy. Remember, this song and three others will be discussed at the conclusion of our program today regarding their radical implications. This is KBOO Portland, and you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now here's Bill Resnick with Travin Lation. How do we stop the scourge of gun violence?
Hi, Travin. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi. Great to be on with you.
Draven is a lefty for all occasions. He's very active in Vermont, president of the Green Mountain Labor Council. He's a longtime socialist and labor activist. He works with the single-payer campaign as well as the Vermont Workers' Council movement, which is quite powerful in the state. He also hosts Equal Time with Travin on WGDR Radio, which is a standard commercial station in Vermont. It includes, of course, a lot of right-wingers who buy their way on. Travin is dueling with them frequently. And hosting interviews, you get some expertise on a lot of things and how our various struggles fit together within U.S. politics as a whole. So, Travin, you've written on gun control, how the left should address the issue, how we understand it, what sorts of demands we must make, and changes we work for. This coming Saturday, there's going to be marches all over the country, including in Portland, marches for our lives called by students, and what promises, of course, to be a huge march in Washington, D.C. My sense is that the left is going to be there, I hope, with leaflets and speakers and a message about how to stop school and other massacres, and indeed how to greatly reduce all gun violence in this country, and violence in this country. You've been thinking about that a lot, Travin. Before, though, we start outlining our leaflet and our statement and what a left can say, let's start with the current moment. What's the significance of the current struggle over gun control?
I'm glad you started out with what's happening among youth. There's a context here. You've got our public school communities, that's the students, teachers, the parents, citizens in general. We've been seeing all of these public institutions targeted with deeper budget cuts. There's greater inequities in the system, harsher penalties for underperforming based on arbitrary testing standards. and now a rise in deadlier gun violence. So it's really no wonder that people are starting to stand up and say they've had it. They've had it with a lot of things, one of which is inaction on school safety. So you've got this March for Our Lives, which, you know, may have a million people expected to join that this coming weekend. This may be a deepening of a youth radicalization, which we've begun to see in recent years. I think we started to see that with Occupy. We saw it with the attraction of many youth to the Sanders movement. And now, you know, there's this critical issue of people not feeling safe at school, and rightly so. They raise the questions of gun control, which is a complex and difficult issue in the United States, more than anywhere else in the world, probably.
Oh, that's for sure. There seems to be one additional factor that comes into it. It's the NRA and its power over politics and politicians and its capacity, and the NRA's composition, which is basically a lobby for the gun industry. That was the historical funding of it, and still a lot of its funding and its drive is gun store owners and manufacturers. And I think everybody recognizes the NRA as an enormous detriment for this country, and the youth in particular. It seems to me, though, that implicates the entire way the economic system is now dominated by the various industries who are making this country so much more unequal and so much more violent. And that's a very powerful understanding to come to for 16-year-olds and younger.
I think where I might differ with you a little bit is I see the NRA as a very complex organization. It is a mass organization. Yes, it's a powerful lobbying organization for the gun manufacturers. That's where they get most of their money, most of their finances, more so than from their members. But, you know, they have at least 5 million members and probably another 15 million people who say they're NRA members who don't bother to pay their dues. And that's because they're also a service organization, which gives them a tremendous grassroots power as well as financial and political power in our state capitals and in D.C.'s. Yeah, we're up against a whole gun culture there that has developed and become more brutal, particularly, I think, since the early 1970s, which I think is very much related to general sort of decline in insecurity in this country, which is why the gun control question should be seen in a broader context.
I think what you just said, though, deserves a little more comment, that, in fact, was the NRA at the top and in its political manifestations is just basically interested in selling guns and to anybody, even doesn't want to have background checks or has fought against it, and any kind of gun, nearly, certainly assault rifles. But at the grassroots level, it's a lot of people who do like their guns and see they need them for self-protection or for feeling manly or womanly or able to deal with the society. It seems to me the gun is a symbolic object as well, and it performs a very important service for a lot of people and makes them feel more secure in a very insecure world. But those people, I think, are not, in fact, interested in just making profits from guns. And I think it's not impossible to erode their support. I agree entirely. Like all organizations in the United States, there's a complex membership of all kinds of complicated drives.
You're right. And I just, on a personal note, Bill, I should mention, I grew up as an NRA member, you know, and was a member. And yeah, I was a member for a long time until in the mid-70s, it became clear to me what their political trajectory was, which didn't really represent my values anymore. But yeah, and you know, you and I, we both live in rural states, and you know, there are a lot of folks who I respect who belong to the NRA because they get proper weapons training, you know, they're hunters. But yeah,
there are other, though, gun organizations. Actually, the hunters broke off from the NRA when they went right wing. It's possible that the NRA could split. You see letters to the editor from people who value their guns and see them as sports things, and they like hunting, and they say, but the NRA does not represent me. At least those letters are now being printed.
Really?
Now back to the big issue that we want to talk about, which is how a left should be talking about gun control. There's a tremendous national conversation this coming Saturday. Of course, there's the march in Washington, D.C., which could get up to 1 million people. Who knows? They stopped counting. And they're demanding action by every level of government. There's also going to be a march in Portland, incidentally. We should announce it, with students, called by students. It's next Saturday, which is the 24th. Coincides with the March on Washington, actually. It starts at 10:30 in Terry Schrunk Plaza and winds around a bit to get to Pioneer Courthouse Square. Anyway, back to, though, the question of how we should be talking to people, that is KBOO Radio and the Old Mole Variety Hour, certainly. The question for the left and Equal Time Radio with Travin, how do we enter that conversation? What should we say? Leaflets and statements and family discussions. How do we stop the massacres? But then it seems to me we have to ask the question how to greatly reduce all gun violence. Let's do an outline of the things that really have to be said now.
Well, I mean, I think we need to start out solidarizing with the students and at the same time laying out a position, as we understand it, on the real causes and cures of U.S. violence. And I think we've got to be clear that those are very much related to the real causes are related to the problems of poverty and inequality and alienation that underlie gun violence. Frankly, there's the question of the police in this society, which should not be ignored. The militarization of the police and the whole context, particularly, I think, since the Vietnam War, really the brutalization of millions of people in the United States, and this is, what, just now the 50th anniversary of the massacre at My Lai, where you had U.S. troops entering a neutral village, killing something like 500 people, mostly women and children. That came home very much in the late 1960s, and you saw the rise, together with, you know, opportunistic politicians emphasizing white fears about black rebellions in the cities and crime. You saw the tremendous acceleration in the buying of guns, particularly handguns, in the United States, and the rise of more and more violence, gun-driven violence. That's a real change in gun culture in the United States, beginning with, you know, the Vietnam War, and of course wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and all of that only continues to deepen that gun culture and that violence that's brought home.
Yeah, let me state a hypothesis. My sense is that right now in the United States, the entirety of the working class, which is, 80%, 85% of the people who can be considered as sort of wage workers without wealth or proper or real big property, certainly can't live independently of their monthly or bimonthly check. There's a great fear and growing fear, it seems to me, of destitution, actually. People lose, you know, jobs are no longer a lifetime. Mm-hmm. People are extremely insecure. They have big mortgages. They have all sorts of expenses. Their kids want to have a good life, and how are they ever going to afford college? And that goes way up the ladder. And many of them, of course, can't afford college and realize they're in an underclass forever, unless one of the kids somehow manages to break free, which is happening less and less in this society. There used to be a lot of social mobility, not very much anymore. In any event, the precariousness of life creates fear, and yet that fear can't be channeled into fighting your boss, because, of course, you're dependent on the job. You can't. For a lot of people, they're stuck in whatever place they live, and they have to maintain not just their job, but they have to keep businesses in their community or face the Rust Belt and desolation. So people are not blaming, my hypothesis is that instead of blaming the powers that be and the corporate apparatus and its elites and the banks and the financial system that is just draining off the economy, draining the blood of the people, really, that old metaphor, it seems to me instead of that, they're very vulnerable to this fear that's created, the fear of immigrants. They're the ones who are doing it. It's those blacks who are ruining our economy. The whole right knows that the reason there was this huge financial collapse in 2008 was the requirement on banks to stop redlining black areas. That's their theory. It was blacks and liberals who are destroying this country and destroying them. Mm-hmm. They're very vulnerable to those ideas. I think in some ways owning a gun is therefore a way of finding security. At least when they break into my house and try and kill my family, I can shoot back or something like that. And I think it's a displacement, a horrible displacement of fear. I'm not sure that may be too absurdly psychological, but I have the sense that that's happening now, that it's a response by people.
Well, Bill, your sense is actually validated by research that's been done. There's a book by Jennifer Carlson, Citizen Protectors, The Everyday Politics of Guns in an Age of Decline. And what's clear, this is something that's particularly impacted men, where you used to have stable jobs, and particularly there were lots of good union jobs in certain parts of the country where you had strong unions. You could have the man could be bringing home the money and supporting an entire family. Now you have two paycheck families. People are struggling. They don't know what's going to happen in the future. There's tremendous insecurity, particularly since the most recent Great Recession. And men frequently, you know, their masculinity is men and mine. Hey, I'm a guy. I'm that demographic, is threatened by the fact that we're no longer the provider for the family. So the studies indicate that one of the ways for feeling better about your own self-image is to become like the protector of your family or the protector of your community. So you go out and particularly handguns. This is where the tremendous growth in guns is, and the tremendous growth in terms of deaths in this country. It's primarily handguns, not assault weapons. And of course, it's suicides, particularly among white men. I think in Vermont, for example, 89% of gun deaths in recent years have been suicides. I mean, that says something about the tremendous despair and alienation that exists in white rural communities. So okay. You're on to something. This is very much about the age of decline.
And those are the suicides by guns. There's probably just as many suicides by drugs, drug overdoses, or unintentional suicides with a lot of sort of deep unconscious motivations. This is KABU Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Traven Lation. Traven is host of Equal Time Radio in Vermont. It's a big commercial station. Traven's been an activist in a variety of movements and especially knows gun control. In fact, was an NRA member in his youth, came from those roots. We've been talking about gun control and how to stop massacres and greatly reduce gun violence. And some of it, of course, is we haven't gotten to all of the details of it. Basically, we're in support of the students and in support of their demands, like banning assault rifles and bump stocks and all of that sort of stuff. Of course, background checks and then more mental health care and schools, and I suppose stop school bullying, which seems to me amongst it. It seems to me we agree that those are good demands, but we went much further in this conversation into the fact that really the economy and culture of this country have to be changed, and there's possibilities of doing that. Why don't you have comment on that? Then we can get back to the problem of police that we do not have an answer to, but we really, really have to mention in this whole context. So first, say a few things about standard responses that are being demanded now of the legislators and being resisted by the NRA, and then we can get to the problem of police.
Well, we do need reasonable limits on the type of firearms that are available and also restrictions on the ability of people with a history of violence and threats of violence to have access to them. And I think you've laid out some of those and the correct demands that students are making. But, you know, we also have to talk about, and this is controversial, but the demilitarization of the police and, frankly, demilitarization of our public schools. You have armed police and others in what, 30% of public schools already. It's being advocated now that there be more guns in the schools. And that's what we see is where that's already happened. It just means that more kids are being thrown out of school and you've got the school-prison pipeline operating more efficiently. I think we need to get both the NRA and ROTC, ROTC, out of our schools. And most, you know, really most important, and we have to make the links here, there's got to be full funding for social service programs in the schools, training counselors, school psychologists, and dealing with the fundamental problems in this country by pressing the demands for things like a 15-hour minimum wage and other anti-poverty measures, a socialized healthcare system, maybe beginning with single payer, that would provide the kind of mental health care that would help in a saner, less violent society. These are all things which have to be part of the conversation.
And then let's get to the need for new kinds of policing. And that's underlined by the immense expansion of police forces and power with Homeland Security and border security, more and more private and public police, some of them without weapons, but most of them with weapons, and ever more powerful weapons being supplied by the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice. It's looking more and more like a national police force, and that allied with the army, it seems to me that's a terrible threatening possibility in U.S. life.
We see in this country, I mean, we see that from the Trump administration. We see cultivating it by the fight of relationships, the military, the actual organization of far alt-right militias that are well-armed, and of course, reaching into the police department, actually infiltrating both the police and the military. So the right wing has a long-term strategic, I would say, fascist appetite to be able to use violence against movements, social justice movements, particularly immigrants, black communities, Latino communities, and ultimately the labor movement. So we should be concerned about that, and we've got to be thinking about how we both, I mean, there's a question of self-defense, which has to be taken seriously on the part of social justice movements. That's always been true within the black movement. And the way that gun control has been enforced in the past in this country has always been racist. I mean, quite frankly, you see it's over four times the number of black people that are locked up in relative terms than the white people for carrying guns, even though they have legal permits to carry them. That's the way gun control has been enforced in this country. So there are serious questions of self-defense, also concerns about the cultivation of a fascist fringe within the military.
This is an issue that we'll be talking about for a long time, and it's very threatening. Certainly there's things that can be done with gun violence, and the young people are rising, and the Sanders movement and the rest of it. It seems to me there are possibilities now for a real struggles from below on all of these issues. Traven, thanks so much for talking to us. We'll do it again.
Thanks to you and your listeners. Solidarity.
Right, so long.
Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. How things will get brighter. Someday, yeah, we'll put it together and we'll get it undone. Someday when your head is much lighter.
Well, that was the second of our four inspirational songs, Ooh Child by the Five Stair Steps. This is the OMO Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Is the U.S. headed towards a workers' dystopia, every bit as chilling as the dystopia imagined by George Orwell in his novel 1984, in which peoples of three imagined superstates, Oceania, Eurasia, and East Asia, are victims of perpetual war and omnipresent government surveillance? How could things get more dystopian? U.S. workers may be about to find out. As Orwell foresaw, we've already got perpetual war and ever-increasing government surveillance. But what about omnipresent employer surveillance? It may be coming. Today I'm going to read an article entitled "The Technology Being Used to Control Workers by Tech Companies is Freakishly Dystopian" by Thor Benson. The article was recently published in In These Times. "You've been fired," Benson begins. "According to your employer's data, your facial expression showed you were insubordinate and not trustworthy. You also move your hands at a rate that is considered substandard. Other companies you may want to work for could receive this data, making it difficult for you to find work in this field." In early February, media outlets reported that Amazon had received a patent for ultrasonic wristbands that could track the movement of warehouse workers' hands during their shifts. If workers' hands began moving in the wrong direction, the wristband would buzz, issuing an electronic corrective. If employed, this technology could easily be used to further surveil employees who already work under intense supervision. Whole Foods, which is now owned by Amazon, recently instituted a complex and punitive inventory system where employees are graded based on everything from how quickly and effectively they stock shelves to how they report theft. The system is so harsh, it reportedly causes employees enough stress to bring them to tears on a regular basis. UPS drivers, who often operate individually on the road, are now becoming increasingly surveilled. Sensors in every UPS truck track when drivers' seat belts are put on, when doors open and close, and when the engines start, in order to monitor employee productivity at all times. The technology company Steelcase has experimented with monitoring employees' faces to judge their expressions. The company claims that this innovation, which monitors and analyzes workers' facial movements throughout the workday, is being used for research and to inform the best practices on the job. Other companies are also taking interest in this kind of mood-observing technology, from Bank of America to Cubis Pharmaceuticals Incorporated. These developments are part of a larger trend of workers being watched and judged, often at jobs that offer low pay and demand long hours. Beyond simply tracking work performance, it is becoming more common for companies to monitor the emails and phone calls their employees make, analyzing personal traits along with output. Some companies are now using monitoring techniques referred to as people analytics to learn as much as they can about you, from your communication patterns to what types of websites you visit to how often you use the bathroom. This type of privacy invasion can cause employees immense stress as they work with a constant knowledge that their boss is aware of their every behavior and able to use that against them as they see fit. Louis Maltby, president of the National Work Rights Institute at Cornell University, tells Indian Times that the level of surveillance workers are facing is increasing exponentially. If you look at what some people call people analytics, it's positively frightening, Maltby says. People analytics devices get how often you talk, the tone of your voice, where you are every single second you're at work, and your body language, your facial expressions, and something called patterns of interaction. He explains that some of these devices even record what employees say at work. According to some experts, this high-level employee surveillance may actually harm the companies that use these techniques. In general, people experience more stress when they feel that someone is looking over their shoulder, real or virtual. Michael Childers, director of the School for Workers, tells In These Times, there's a large body of research documenting that stressful workplaces can potentially lead to many problems that reduce company profits, including increased turnover, more sick days, higher workplace compensation costs, and ironically, even lower productivity. Richard Wolff, a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts, tells In These Times that this type of surveillance deepens the antagonism, mutual suspicion, and hostility of employers relative to employees. It degrades work morale and will probably fail, leading employers to conclude not that such surveillance is a bad idea, but rather that they need to automate to get rid of workers altogether. While this level of worker surveillance may be alarming, it has so far gone largely unchecked. Congress has never passed a law to regulate employee surveillance, Maltby says, and he doesn't think it will come anytime soon. However, he says that either Congress or the Supreme Court could finally decide that employers have gone too far when they start tracking employee movement during a worker's time off. The fight we're gearing up for is tracking behavior off-duty, Maltby says. Every cell phone in America has GPS capabilities baked into it, along with cameras and microphones. Maltby worries that employers could soon begin using this technology to track the behavior of their employees outside of work. If this were to happen, Maltby believes, U.S. lawmakers could be impelled to step in. One of the fears that labor and privacy advocates hold is that over time, workers could get used to these types of invasions and begin accepting them as a normal part of the job. The first time people hear about the newest privacy invasion, they get extremely angry, but eventually they just get used to it. For example, at many jobs, drug tests are now seen as standard, despite the fact that they invade employees' private lives by monitoring their behaviors outside of work. At a time of soaring inequality, low-wage workers are bearing the brunt of efforts to increase productivity and profits. The rise of the new tracking techniques show that companies are moving toward increasing their control over the lives of their employees. While workers at the bottom of the wage scale may be the first to face such dystopian working conditions, other industries could soon embrace them. If we don't want to live and work under the constant supervision of a faraway boss, now is the time to speak up and push back. That was an article entitled, "The Technology Being Used to Control Workers by Tech Companies is Freakishly Dystopian," by Thor Benson. Benson has been a contributor to Truth Dig, State, Vice, Fast Company, and many other publications.
Well, the oppressors are trying to keep me down, trying to drive me underground, and they think that they have got the battle won. I say forgive them, Lord, they know not what they've done, 'cause as sure as the sun will shine, I'm gonna get my share now.
Jimmy Cliff, The Harder They Fall. This is the Old Mo Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now Larry Bolden is here to discuss a genre of fiction that Amazon labels as women's fiction or romance fiction. Larry begs to differ with these critical-sounding labels. Larry?
With Women's Day just behind us, I'm focusing my reading this month on women authors. I notice more and more when I peruse big distributors like Amazon that there is now a genre called women's fiction. Not so long ago, this same genre might have been called romance novels, and I take both designations as at least faintly negative, alerting readers that this is light fiction, all about squishy love and relationships, unlike the more muscled, serious literature produced by men. In fact, if a reader really wants to read about relationships between men and women, women and women, parents and children, and even our relationships with other animals, I think the category to look to is women's fiction. Indeed, when I look back over women authors of the last century or more, I think most could be put in this category. Simone de Beauvoir, Iris Murdoch, Penelope Lively, Doris Lessing, even Nadine Gordimer write primarily about family and relationships. Yes, Murdoch's novels are deeply philosophical and Gordimer's deeply political, but the stories told are about relationships. Take, for example, one of Gordimer's last novels, A Sport of Nature, which was written after the end of apartheid and is probably one of her best feminist novels. Lively's The Photograph, Doris Lessing's The Golden Notebook, Simone de Beauvoir's The Mandarins, all of these novels are about relationships, and all, as I read them, are feminist novels. But I want to put in a word or two for even more popular so-called romance writers like Jojo Moyes, Joan Silber, and Miranda Beverly Whittemore. Recently, after finishing an agonizingly long and gruesome psychological thriller, a reader loaned me a stack of library books when I told her I needed to read something more hopeful and optimistic. The stack included Jojo Moyes' The Last Letter from Your Lover and The Horse Dancer, both of which were deeply perceptive about how relationships go wrong and how they can sometimes be righted, perhaps with just a few moments of real honesty or a real attempt to unself, in Murdoch's words, that is, to really attend to the other. The Horse Dancer not only reveals much about how secrets and hiding of insecurities prevent real understanding between lovers and between children and parents, it also describes a beautiful relationship between a girl and her horse, and much advice about how we ought to attend to and treat animals in our lives. Now, I agree that romance novels often become formulaic, with too much talk of six-pack abs and hot, smoky sex, and, as in The Last Letter from Your Lover, too much jerking around of the readers, first giving one hope of a breakthrough, a reunion, a happy ending, and then ripping the carpet out from under these hopes, only to begin to build a new anticipation of resolution, a new thread of hope, cut off again and again. Still, the characters in the novels mentioned are believable and fully fleshed out, and the circumstances usually quite plausible. Miranda Beverly Whittemore's fine novel, Set Me Free, not only describes human relationships well and perceptively, it also tells us a lot about racism and the broken promises Native Americans have continually faced. I'm sure some readers would want to insist that Set Me Free is much more than a romance or a women's fiction book, but my point is that many of this poorly defined genre are much more than romances. I learned long ago that I loved what many critics deride as chick flicks, for many of the same reasons I find so-called romance novels important and uplifting. When I look back and recall why I so loved Edith Wharton, Alice Munro, Willa Cather, I discover that it was their acute understanding of relationships that endeared me to them. Would Jane Austen and Emily Bronte, were they writing today, be labeled romance writers? Certainly relationships between lovers were key parts of their works. At various times in my reading life, I've rejected whole genres of writing, science fiction, mysteries, only to discover later that my reasons were superficial and largely unjustified. so-called romance novels are, I suppose, my latest treasure trove of overlooked or too quickly rejected novels. Jojo Moyes has made me laugh out loud and cry as she describes the sad but often laughable antics of lovers. I have not learned much from self-help books on how to make relationships work or how when to jettison ones that don't. But novels, especially those by women, have shown me just how deceit tarnishes and or destroys relationships, and how even a few moments of real honesty can restart a relationship in trouble. I am a reader who loves to read about families, and here again I think the place to go is often this slippery genre I'm trying to characterize. Next week I will return to my usual habit of reviewing a single novel when I review René Denfeld's excellent last novel, The Child Finder, another novel primarily about relationships. But today I'm happy to be recommending to you women's fiction, which is neither soft nor shallow. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I keep my hands on myself. Think I'll dust them off, put them back up on the shelf. Just a little baby girl is in need. Am I coming out of left field?
This is KBOO Portland, the Old Mole Variety Hour. You just heard the last of the four songs that we are featuring on today's program. That was called Feel It Still by Portugal the Man. Now concluding our program today, Bill Resnick is back, and with him is Jeff Hunt, a Portlander who knows a lot about popular music and its contribution to radical left politics. Bill?
Well, thank you, Tom, and Jeff Hunt, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Jeff is one of our current, I think our latest, music moles. He engineers at KBOO, has a deep interest in knowledge and popular music. That is music, popular music developed from the mole's perspective, from the grassroots, aiming for a working class audience, to inform and activate people and do it with feeling. So, Jeff, we planned last night to do three sort of inspirational songs and talk about the double-edged nature of inspirational songs.
Yes, yes.
And then last night we discovered that Portugal, the man, is singing, who won a Grammy Award for his song, Feel It Still, that people just heard most of your excerpt of it. So it seems to me we're going to be talking about two things.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is sort of the inspiration, the two-edged nature of inspirational stuff. The second thing we need to talk about is that song, which is quite powerfully radical, actually. It's a
Yeah, it is.
And he wrote it, actually. He says in his liner notes, I'm not sure they're liner notes. Anyway, he's quoted as saying he was inspired by the Sanders campaign, by sort of the rebirth of struggle. Anyway, and he's going to be playing at the great, going to be a huge march on the East Coast in Washington, D.C. It will be enormous, but there's going to be also marches all over the West Coast, including in Portland on next Saturday at gathering at 10:30 at Terry Schrunk Plaza. Terry Schrunk, you know, was an old DA here.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wish they would change the name because he was very right-wing, as was his son.
Yeah.
Even worse. But it's Terry Schrunk Plaza. We'll forget about him.
Yeah, yeah. They'll name things after anybody, I suppose.
Yeah. Only lefties. I'm sorry.
Abby Hoffman Square.
That's great. Why don't we? Well, Abby was actually a good fellow. The yuppies, on the other hand, a lot of them degenerated.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm afraid.
His old pal. I forget his name now.
Yeah. Yeah, forever to be forgotten. But Abby was really good. In any event, yeah, there's going to be the rally at Abby Hoffman Square.
Terry Schrunk Plaza, yeah.
Terry Schrunk Plaza.
Yeah, formerly known as Trey.
And it was called by students, and this fellow who wrote Feel It Still, this radical song, was a Portland grunge indie favorite, and he's made it big, winning that Grammy. I guess that's the mark of making it big.
By a certain measure, yes.
Anyway, let's talk, though, about first the inspirational songs, and then we can talk about Feel It Still and this rise of radical music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about those inspirational songs you chose to us for us, though, to begin with?
Yeah. You sent this email to me last week, Bill, saying, hey, would you like to pick some music? We have a liberatory democratic theme. And I thought, yeah, I can certainly do that. And I thought about it for a couple of days, and nothing was coming to mind because I was thinking, well, I listen to certain kinds of music maybe your listeners might not enjoy, or that might not be a good fit for the show. And so I took the liberatory democracy theme less literally, and I thought, well, let's feature some songs that have the message about the struggle, the message about overcoming, and put that put it in a very positive and optimistic light. And then once I got your opinion on these songs, I realized maybe I had not done, you know, I was working with the best I had, but you brought up some interesting points that I hadn't really considered, where it's really about, some songs are about the individual overcoming and succeeding at whatever they wish to do, and then the collective, the group, overcoming and succeeding at what they want to do.
The other songs that talk about we have to act,
yeah.
Right.
One day we'll walk in the rays of a beautiful sun, that kind of thing, you know, from that Five Stair Steps song.
Right.
Yeah.
The Child.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And yeah, my sense of those inspirationals is sometimes they backfire, and they're extremely, in fact, undermining of people. Rather than inspiring them, they undermine, because, I mean, I sort of began recognizing that one day when, quite a long time ago, when Jesse Jackson went back to Chicago and called a mass march, and it wasn't a march, it was an audience, basically, for a talk seen as a rally, and before the talk, you had everybody all assembled, mostly youthful black and brown people, saying, I am a man.
Yeah.
I am a man. I stand up. I am a man. And I thought,
my favorite is when he gets the audience to participate. I am a man. A man.
Really?
Yeah.
I never had heard that one, but
that's a popular expression of his, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the problem with that is, it seems to me that that kind of thing, I'm a man, I can stand up, I can...
Which doesn't say anything about the ladies in the audience.
I'm demanding respect as a man, whatever, even sexism, but that's not the worst of it. The problem is, they don't do that at Harvard and Yale or Princeton. It's gather all their students to stand up and say, I am a man. Well, those people know, all the men and women, that they're going to go to Wall Street or whatever, or to Washington, D.C., or to the big corporations, or maybe even to the universities.
Yeah.
Some of them lefties.
Yeah.
They know they're in fine shape. Anybody who stands them up and says has to say, I am a man, you know, it's sort of ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you take a kid who's coming from a family where his father is working at some very low-paid job, unable to pay the rent, his
mother's... get some kid from, like, Baltimore, Philly, Detroit, you know.
All of the...
Yeah.
And white working class kids, too, who are basically stuck now in poverty. You say, I am a man. It's sort of almost a statement, well, my parents are really, I am a man who comes from a family who can't make it, and I'm never going to make it. It seems to me what you're doing is disempowering people by with that kind of inspirational. And anyway, but some of them are we. We have to build a movement.
Yeah.
We can do it. And that one, it seems to me, those have a lot more promise.
Yeah, yeah. And they're more universally appealing as well. The one track that we got, The Harder They Come by Jimmy Cliff, you know, I was explaining to you last night, you know, that is the title track off the movie soundtrack for a Jamaican gangster film, an exploitation film from the 70s. It's a great movie. It's difficult to watch without subtitles if you're not familiar with the patois, but... Yeah, this kid comes from the country. He's got nothing. He wants to make it as a musician. Ends up becoming a gangster in Kingston, Jamaica. And it's about him getting his slice of the pie in the sky and so on. So it's very much about the individual in that case.
That one, too.
But it speaks to breaking out of poverty, although by nefarious means.
Right. And he becomes a man, all right.
He also gets killed by the police.
Oh, yes. Oh, well.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees. You know that one? But, of course, his rebellion was a hopeless and absurd one.
Just grinding poverty.
Yeah. But there's something to be said for standing up to the power. On the other hand, that way doesn't just leads to prison or death.
Mm-hmm.
This song, Feel It Still, is another side of the whole story, it seems to me. Tell us, the lyrics really are interesting. I could only read it. I couldn't. You can't hear the lyrics, at least I couldn't. Could you hear the lyrics when you played it?
No. Honestly, wasn't familiar with the song until you brought it up to
really?
Me. I tend to listen to older stuff. Yeah. So
anyway, but this song, Portugal, the man, mm-hmm. who's this Portland guy who became well-known and won a Grammy, he's going to be singing at that. He's going to be doing music at that rally.
Oh, he's going to be there Saturday.
The student rally, right. He's going to be doing a lot of music, and he supports it, and, mm-hmm. and he supports the struggle, and he's going to be there. Tell us a little bit. We only have a minute now,
yeah.
Jeff. The lyrics, it seems to me, are really good, and it really calls for... Explain the song a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at lyrics right now, and the first line that grabbed my eye when I grabbed the sheet of paper, "We could fight a war for peace. We could wait until the walls come down. It's time to give a little to the kids in the middle." You know, talking about other people, what I can do
yeah.
or what this individual can do for other
he's
people.
He's sort of speaking for working people, actually.
Yeah,
saying,
yeah.
We were fighting before in the 60s and the 80s. We were crushed.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can come back again, and I still feel the rebellion.
Yeah.
That was really...
Yeah.
I think that's
and how nice of him to put it in a song too, so that you know other folks, other young folks, can hear this and go, "Ah, oh, maybe that sounds awfully appealing, don't
yeah.
it?" Yeah.
Anyway, he's a musician for our time. It's also sort of hipster.
Yeah.
sort of tones. Jeff, good talking to you.
Thank you. Yeah, always good talking to you.
And now we're going to go back to Tom Becker, who's going to sign off, I believe.
That's right, Bill. That concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Thanks to Old Mole's Lori Bolden and Bill Resnick for their contributions today, and to Bill's guests, Travin Lation on gun violence and Jeff Hunter on radical, inspirational music. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs.